From WKAR's Studio S at Michigan State University, this is Current Sports.
Hey, what's going on, beautiful people? I am your host, Al Martin, and welcome to another fantastic edition of Current Sports. It is Hump Day, Wednesday, April 9th, 2014. As always, we have a great show in store for you. In just a sec, we will be chatting with Richard Kincaid, who is an author and broadcaster who has been covering Michigan State and also Detroit sports for quite some time. You don't want to miss that interview. He'll be joining us around the 1:15-ish point during the show. And also some, of course, many of you have probably heard this and woke up in the morning, especially those of Spartan Nation, woke up in the morning and read the paper or turned on your laptop and looked at the headliners and saw that the sad passing of 8-year-old Lacey Holdsworth. Now, for those who don't know, Lacey Holdsworth is the adorable young woman who was shown time in and time out throughout the entire NCAA tournament. When Michigan State was playing, she was diagnosed with cancer and was fighting this disease for quite some time and grew a very interesting, a very precious relationship with Michigan State's center, senior center, Adrian Payne. And to be frank with you, the entire Michigan State basketball team and in turn, Spartan Nation. It was really, really sad news. She passed away this morning. On the show, we're going to, talk about what this meant to the MSU men's basketball team, what this means to Adrian Payne, and what this means to Spartan Nation. Sad, sad news. Again, if you want to share your thoughts on this this very sad topic, 517-355-9527. Again, that's 517-355-9527. We'll talk about it later on in the hour. And also we'll talk about UConn. The UConn women, they finished business against Notre Dame yesterday in what was probably had to be one of the highest-rated women's basketball games in quite some time, as both teams undefeated came into that when UConn getting the win. So they are on the Mount Olympus now of women's and men's college basketball. What a game it was. And UConn really just handled business throughout the stretch of that game. We'll talk about that and so much more. Again, you can call in and share your thoughts on anything we talk about here on Current Sports by picking up that phone and dialing 517-355-9527. So let's waste no time. Let's dive into it because we do have a ton to talk about in so little time. Here are your current sports quick hit headliners for this April 9th, 2014. Again, 8-year-old Lacey Holdsworth. Again, her battle with cancer and friendship with Michigan State basketball became national stories. She passed away this morning, losing her battle with cancer. Now, it inspired immediate emotion from MSU men's basketball coach Tom Izzo. He said in a phone interview today, quote, "I'm supposed to be a guy who leads men, and now an 8-year-old has impacted my life like this. The impact on all of us will be lasting, and that's especially true for Adrian Payne." Now, it also inspired ESPN analyst Dick Vitale to call Lacey's father, Matt Holdsworth, and tell him he's going to donate $250,000 in her name, with fundraising starting now at DickVitale.com. Vitale said in a phone interview this morning before sobbing for several seconds, quote, "I can't believe it. This rips my heart out, man." Very, very sad stuff there. Now, Lacey's family also posted the following on Instagram around 3 a.m. this morning. Quote, "Princess Lacey has achieved the ultimate victory. She now dances among angels. The world is a better place because you were in it. Our hearts are broken. We love you, Dal. Dance all night. Mommy and Daddy, Will, Mitchell, and Luke. Pound love like Lacey." Sad stuff there. Again, 8-year-old Lacey Holdsworth, her battle with cancer and her tremendous impact with the MSU men's basketball team. She passed away this morning, losing her battle with cancer. We'll be talking about this very touchy topic later on in the show. If you want to express your condolences to Lacey to Lacey's family, you can do so by calling 517-355-9527. We'll talk about it later on today's show. Okay, well, there's no question now, folks, that the UConn Huskies are the creme de la creme of the basketball world, winning national championships in both men's and women's college basketball. Gino Auriemma and UConn. They reached the top of the women's college basketball world in unprecedented fashion last night. The Huskies reached the pinnacle in style, routing Notre Dame in the first NCAA basketball championship game featuring undefeated teams. Ari Emma and his Huskies now have one more title than Pat Summitt in Tennessee for most all time. My goodness, and they did it in the Hall of Famers' backyard. We'll dive into and break that game down and talk about just the powerhouse now when it comes to UConn basketball. Again, national titles in both men and women's basketball. That is certainly one unbelievable accomplishment, to say the least. We'll also be talking about that during our second segment on today's Current Sports. And in less than a month, Floyd Mayweather, this is a pretty interesting story. Floyd Mayweather Jr. will be back in the ring in less than a month with a payday that's likely to exceed around $30 million in guarantees again. So it looks like he pocketed some loose change over the weekend. Now, Mayweather bet $37,000 on UConn to cover the second half spread against Florida. Now, the Huskies were 6-point underdogs in the second half, but actually outscored the Gators 38-31. Now, UConn won the game 63-53 to advance to the national title game. Mayweather then bet $30,000 on the money line for the Huskies to beat Kentucky. That means UConn not only had to cover the spread, but it also had to win the game, which they did. They won Monday 60-44 for their second national title in 4 years. The man won a grand total of $75,636. That is unbelievable stuff. Mayweather is just racking in the dough. They don't call him Money Mayweather for nothing, folks. All right, and interesting story here. UMass shooting guard Derek Gordon became the first openly gay Division I basketball player, publicly sharing his story with ESPN and OutSports yesterday. Now, Gordon told his family, coaches, and teammates earlier this month, and he said he was influenced by last April's announcement from NBA veteran Jason Collins. Quote, "I didn't want to have to lie or sneak. I've been waiting and watching for the last few months, wondering when a Division I player would come out, and I finally just said, why not me?" That's what Gordon said in an interview with ESPN. That certainly takes a lot of courage. And the Red Wings, they are on another step closer to the playoffs. After last night's 4-2 win over the Buffalo Sabres in Buffalo, Darren Helm broke a 1-1 tie early in the third period, and the Wings tallied 3 goals in the final stanza to earn the win. Jimmy Howard, he made 25 saves for the Wings, who need just 1 point in their last three games, to secure a spot in the postseason for the 23rd consecutive season, one of the most coveted streaks in North American sports history. So the Wings are still alive and looking pretty, pretty good. Now, the Tigers' West Coast trip got off to a slow start as Carl Crawford's 10th inning walk-off double earned the Dodgers a 3-2 win. Max Scherzer, he pitched 7 strong innings, surrendering 2 runs and narrowly avoiding a loss thanks to Victor Martinez's 9th-inning RBI single. Still, the Tigers' bats weren't enough, and Crawford's double snuck past new addition Rajai Davis for the win. Now, Detroit will look for a split tonight in L.A. with the first pitch is set for 10:10 p.m. Eastern time. And on Tuesday night, the Lansing Lugnuts, they won their home opener, a 5-4 victory over Quad Cities. Now, the Quad Cities, they tied the game at 4-4 in the eighth with that's until Dickie Jothine, he extended his hit streak and helped the Lansing Lugnuts win the home opener on a bloop single in the bottom of the ninth. So that's good stuff there. Lansing, the Lugnuts get their opening home opener win. And after a sweep of Siena, MSU baseball was obliterated by Central Michigan University yesterday, 10-1. Jake Boss, head coach Jake Boss Jr., he was not happy after that game, saying, quote, "It's as embarrassing a loss as I think I've had here at Michigan State. And it's not how we play baseball here. It's how we play offensively, defensively, on the mound." So Jake Boss certainly not happy after that one. Again, a 10-1 loss to Central Michigan University yesterday. They try to bounce back today against Western Michigan, 3 o'clock at McLane Baseball Stadium. And the Atlanta Hawks enter tonight's game against the Detroit Pistons. Last night's game against the Detroit Pistons with a 2-game lead over the New York Knicks for the 8th and final playoff spot in the Eastern Conference. But the Pistons look like a playoff team yesterday, at least. Detroit took the game to the Hawks, outscoring them 35-27 in the first quarter and going on to win 102-95 on the road. Rodney Stuckey, he had 29 points, went 12-14 from the free throw line. Both Greg Monroe and Andre Drummond grabbed double-doubles as Monroe finished with 21 points, 13 boards. Drummond scored 19 to go along with 17 rebounds. My goodness, those are impressive numbers. Now the Pistons will play the Cavs tonight as they are wrapping up the season. They have now matched the amount of wins that they had at this point last season as well. So, still the Pistons, though. They're not making the playoffs. So, anyway, all right, those are your current sports quick hit headliners here. If you want to call in and share your thoughts on any of those, you know the number, 517-355-9527. Again, that's 517-355-9527. You can share anything that's on your mind. You can also go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/currentsports and even tweet me at Al Martin WKAR. All right, well, in the meantime, let's invite our guest for today's Current Sports. Now, he began his sportscasting career right here at WKAR Radio. So he's kind of like family, folks. While he was a student at Michigan State, now, while still an undergrad at MSU, he began covering the Detroit Tigers for a Lansing radio station, has been covering sports in Detroit ever since. He was the play-by-play voice of the Grand Rapids Griffins, which are the Red Wings' top farm club, for several seasons. He is the author of two books and is in the process of collaborating on a third title. Richard Kincaid, welcome to Current Sports. How you doing, Richard? Do we have him, Aaron? Richard, how you doing? Welcome to Current Sports.
Great to be with you, Al. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining me today. Now, Richard, first of all, going back, because I had no idea. You're kind of like family here at WKAR. You first got your start here at WKAR Radio. Take us back to that time, and how did you get involved with sportscasting here as an undergrad?
Well, I'll tell you, when I started at Michigan State, my work-study job was operating movie projectors and equipment like that for classrooms, and I thought it was a little bit boring. I looked at the job board, and they had a work study opening in the news department. It had WKAR, which back in those days, you didn't have the nice modern, beautiful facilities that you have now at the Comm Arts Building. We were in the auditorium.
Wow.
And I got the work study job coming in early in the morning to help Kurt Gilio out. Well, with the morning news, and then I would also come in the afternoon from time to time. And one day, Bob Kurtz, who was the sportscaster at the time, had to leave with the football team to go on the road. You know Bob Kurtz. He's the play-by-play voice of the Minnesota Wild now.
Right,
a great
exactly.
Former WKARer. And they asked me if I would be interested in doing the sports that day, which was a 15-minute sportscast. I think it came out at like 4:45 to 5 o'clock.
Right.
And, I was nervous as heck, just a sophomore there at Michigan State. And I said, well, sure. And I did the sports, and I just haven't stopped ever since.
Oh, that is great stuff, Richard. I'm pretty sure, you being a sophomore and just having to take the helm during that moment, that had to be quite a moment for you, and I'm pretty sure you got hooked after that. Now, how in the world did you get your foot in the door to cover a professional sports team like the Detroit Tigers while still in undergrad? Richard, that's pretty impressive.
Well, I had a job doing the midday news at, Whittle, WITL, the country station there in Lansing.
Right.
And I was doing the midday news. Our news director in those days was a guy named Dwayne Stacker, and he was a pretty unusual guy. He would do morning drive. He would take a break, maybe 4 hours to midday, and then come back and do afternoon drive. And I was the guy that would come in and do those newscasts at 11 o'clock in the morning, noon, 1 o'clock, that sort of thing, until Dwayne came back. And one day I asked Dwayne, because I had an interest in sports, I asked him how much it cost to cover the Detroit Tigers, and he said, "Oh, I think it probably cost $700 or $800 for the whole season."
Right.
And so my heart sank because I'm figuring that's not going to be in the budget.
Right.
And then just for the heck of it, I called the Tigers and I got their public relations director, Hal Middlesworth, who was kind of turns out he was a great guy, but for a young kid calling him out of the blue, he's a little bit crotchety and a little bit skeptical.
Right.
And I said to him, "How much does it cost to get a credential to cover the Tigers?" And there was silence on the other end of the line. And finally he says, "Well, it's free to accredited members of the media."
Right.
And so my next question was, "Well, how do you get accredited?" And, you know, and he says, well, you have to fill out a form, send me a letter, yada, yada. And I talked to the our bosses there at WITL, pitched him on a series of daily reports that would, you know, cover the Detroit Tigers. I think I did like 8 a day.
Wow.
3 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, a couple in the evening. I was on all the time doing these 60 or 90-second updates on the Tigers. It was called Tiger Report.
Right.
Clever name.
Oh,
but
that's
anyways,
very creative.
Yeah, that's what happened. Our expense essentially was to install a phone in the press box at Tiger Stadium. And so there I found myself, not yet 22 years old, honestly walking on the field at Tiger Stadium covering Major League Baseball. It was remarkable. I think it was my second day there, and I'm standing by the batting cage, which you can't do that now, but back then you could. You could just walk up during BP and lean against the cage.
Yeah.
And Ernie Harwell walks up to me.
Oh, wow.
I know, right? Sticks out his hand and says, hello, young man, I'm Ernie Harwell. And I'm thinking, well, duh. Right?
Right, exactly.
He talked to me for about 10 minutes, you know, asked me what I was doing and who I was working for, and it just could not have been nicer. And, you know, you always hear that phrase, it made me feel like I was 10 feet tall. It really, literally did.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had been super nervous. But after I had that talk with Ernie Harwell, I just sort of said to myself, you know, if it's okay with Ernie Harwell that I'm here,
you're supposed to be
okay.
There. Yeah,
and,
exactly.
I must belong here. So after that, I wasn't nervous. And my first season, Ralph Houk was the manager. That was 1978. And then the next season, they started with Ralph Houk retired at the end of the year. They brought in Les Moss to manage in 1979. And then it was either late May or early June. I'm going to go with early June. Mm-hmm. Out of the blue, they fired Les Moss because a week or two earlier, a guy named Sparky Anderson.
Oh, yeah, I know him.
Hired as manager of the Cincinnati Reds, and the Tigers hired him. And so I spent my formative years when I was just a wee bitty baby sportscaster, working with Sparky Anderson, and he's got a passage in he's got two or three books out. Well, I should say had. He passed on, of course.
Right.
But in one of his books, he talks about young reporters coming into his office, and he said you can just see by the look in their eyes they're scared to death. They're going, oh my God, what am I doing here? That sort of thing. And it occurred to me that when he wrote that paragraph, he may well have been talking about me because I was still, you know, for the longest time in a pretty good state of awe.
Right.
talking to major leaguers like they were just, you know, like ordinary people or something. So it was it was a great way to start.
That is that's an unbelievable story, Richard. And when you first started covering the Tigers and you got approved for that media credential, what year were you still in college? What year were you in college?
Let's see. Well, I was a senior.
Okay.
So I was getting close to graduating. But it definitely changed the course of my life. I think my plan at that time, pardon me, was to finish and go on to law school. But golly, you know, it's kind of
wow.
There's an allure there. If you're figuring, geez, I'm like 22 years old and I'm covering the majors. You know, things might work out if I do this. And so I loved it. And so I just I stayed with it. And so here I am today, still talking to major league ballplayers as though they were normal people or something.
There you have it. Now, Richard,
yeah.
You know, something really cool is that tomorrow there will be a pretty cool event here, right here on the campus of Michigan State University, at the College of Communication Arts and Sciences, an event called the Spartan Sports Journalism Classic, where a few MSU sports reporting alum will come back and get to talk to students and chat to those who are interested in the business about what it takes to be successful and how to get your foot in the door, like you just explained. Now, looking back at your time here, Richard, and the success you've gone on to have, what advice would you give to those students who are tuned in right now?
Have a fallback position. Give it everything you've got in terms of your broadcasting career, but it's always good to have a fallback position because this business is not unlike coaching. You're sort of hired to be fired. I mean, it's happened to me a number of times in my career. It's never easy, but if you have a skill, a trade, something that you can fall back on to sort of tide you over in those dry periods, and they will occur inevitably.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that I wish I'd done. I almost wish I'd gone ahead and gone to law school so I could be a lawyer and a sportscaster. I think if I had it to do over again, I probably would have pursued that course. But again, you know, put your heart and your soul and your mind into it. Give it everything you got, but just make sure that you've got some skill. Doesn't matter what it is, just something there to tide you over when, especially early in your career when you're developing your name and your talent.
Mm-hmm.
Just something that'll tide you over until things work out.
Richard, in those moments, like you said, when you were fired and let go, I mean, what kept you going and kept you optimistic about your sportscasting career?
I like to eat.
That's a good answer.
You know, I would think that's it. No, I've always been in that regard fortunate that you know, when one door closed, a window opened, and I was able to scramble in through it. You know, that sort of thing. But plus the longer you're in the business, the more people you meet, the more contacts you make, that sort of thing. You develop a name for yourself and a reputation, and that's always good. And also, I mean, when, for example, I was fired as the broadcaster in Grand Rapids for the hockey team there, it came as a bit of a shock to me because I didn't even know a play-by-play guy could get fired. Mm-hmm. But it did happen to me there, and that gave me the opportunity to, with time on my hands, to go out and write a book, The Gods of Olympia Stadium, which was a terrific experience for me. What I did with that book was essentially copy what a famous author who, incidentally, used to teach economics at Michigan State, a guy
really?
Named Lawrence Ritter, had done back in the 1960s. He wrote a book called The Glory of Their Times, where he went back and interviewed Major League Baseball players who had played 50 years earlier. Now, his book came out in 1966, so we're talking about guys who had played at the turn of the century and into the 1910s and 1920s. Guys,
right.
for example, who had played in the outfield next to Ty Cobb. And they told such wonderful stories, and it was really a terrific book. And what happened was I was in the library in Grand Rapids one day, again, time on my hands because I'd just been fired.
Yeah.
And I had gotten that book when I was a little boy. And I saw it on the shelf of the library. I said, oh, yeah, I remember that book from when I was a kid. And I checked it out just to, you know, I'd kind of forgotten about it. And I read it, and it really was a terrific book. And I thought to myself, you know, if this works with baseball players, perhaps it would work with hockey players. And it just happened that I ran into Bill Gadsby, a guy who played 20 years in the NHL.
Yeah.
He closed out
yeah.
his career in Detroit, and I ran into him at an event and asked him for an interview, and he was very gracious. He said, sure, he'd be happy to sit down with me. So a few days later, I found myself with my tape recorder and Bill Gadsby sitting in a booth in a restaurant just talking hockey for a couple, 3 hours, and in the course of that interview, he mentioned so many names that I was embarrassed in some cases because he was talking about guys that I'd never heard of.
Right.
There was a guy named Doug McCaig, who I guess was the most feared guy in the National Hockey League in the 1940s and the 1950s. He talked about a guy named Mariucci, who used to play for the Blackhawks, and Bill Gadsby said he was the toughest guy he'd ever seen on the ice. And it turns out that if you go to a Golden Gophers hockey game on mm-hmm. the campus of the University of Minnesota, they play at Mariucci Arena.
Right.
So this guy actually was very famous.
Wow.
But for whatever reason, I'd never heard of him. But at any rate, over the course of that conversation, he mentioned so many names, and I started jotting them down, and then I would just go and track those individuals down. And what was amazing to me, for example, I would call Red Kelly, very famous defenseman with the Red Wings in the 1950s, where he won 4 Stanley Cups, and then he kind of got into a tiff, sort of what had happened to me, I suppose, got into a tiff with his boss, the then general manager of the Red Wings, Jack Adams, and in a fit of pique, I think that's how you pronounce that, Al, I'm not sure, P-I-C-Q-U-E,
right.
Adams traded him, and Kelly traded him to the Rangers, and Kelly said, I'm not going to report. He was like the first athlete in history to veto a trade like that, saying he quit rather than go play for the New York Rangers, because at the time the Rangers were a terrible organization and a terrible hockey team. And Kelly was actually retired for a week or 10 days or so, and then Punch Imlach in Toronto got the idea that maybe he could trade for Red Kelly, and he sent to Detroit Lesser Bufkus. He sent him some essentially unknown defenseman who just turned out to have no career with Detroit at all. But in return, he got Kelly, who went on to win 4 additional Stanley Cups with Toronto. And but as I say, when I call Red Kelly up, he doesn't know me from Adam.
Right.
And I would say, well, I was talking to Bill Gadsby, and your name came up. And as soon as I said Bill Gadsby, Kelly, he must have figured, well, if Gadsby talked to this guy, then it would be okay for me to talk to this guy. And so then, in that case, I found myself heading off to Toronto to sit down and do an interview with Red Kelly. And so
oh, my goodness. Kind of like a domino effect.
Exactly. I went to the Montreal Canadiens fantasy camp, and I got to interview all these great former Montreal Canadiens, ranging from Elmer Locke, who in his day was the NHL scoring champion before a guy named Rocket Richard came along, and I got to interview Jean Beliveau. It was just amazing.
Yeah.
And basically what we did was compile those interviews And the first book came out, The Gods of Olympia Stadium, and now the second book is out, and it's more of hockey players who played in the 50s and 60s telling me their stories. And the nice thing is, when you get these guys started, it's almost like you're talking hockey with your grandfather, assuming your grandfather played in the National Hockey League.
Just keeps going and going.
Oh, yeah, and their eyes would light up, and you could tell they were right back in the moment. And as soon as I saw that look in their eyes, it occurred to me that it really didn't matter what they were saying, that it was going to read terrific. It was just going to read great, and it turns out that's what happened. All I had to do was turn on the tape recorder and listen. And then, transcribe it. I had to do a few other things to give it flow and a little bit of context and that sort of thing. But the bulk of the work they did for me, I'll be honest with you. But I'm proud of it. It'll stand the test of time. And the thing I'm proudest of all about for a kid that, an ordinary guy there at Michigan State, is that one day I got a letter from the Hockey Hall of Fame, and they asked if I could send them a couple of copies of the book so they could keep it in their library, which is where it will be for all time. And I've sort of got a big ego, I guess, but I figured if my book's in the Hockey Hall of Fame, that means I made it to the Hockey Hall of Fame. So I feel pretty good about that.
That's quite an accomplishment, Richard. Oh, yeah, without a doubt. That's unbelievable stuff. And you talk about, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, if you're just now joining us here on Current Sports, we are talking with an unbelievable guy, Richard Kincaid, sports broadcaster and author. Now, Richard, I want to talk about that latest book, The Legends of the Detroit Red Wings. I mean, what inspired you? I mean, you talk about that whole deal. I mean, it kind of fell into your lap then, I guess, basically, with that domino effect and the continuation of those interviews, and you decided to put together a book. I guess that's how it came about, right?
Yeah, well, I got a call out of the blue about a year ago. It turns out that my original publisher had been bought by another publishing company, and apparently they read the first book and liked it and asked if I could do another one. And I was, well, sure, I said, I could. And so that's how that got going. And actually, one of the things I like best about the project, and if you're going to write a book about the Red Wings championship teams of the 1950s, obviously you're going to interview Gordie Howe. And trust me on this one, sitting there talking hockey with Gordie Howe for a couple of hours is sort of like being on top of Everest talking to Yoda. It's just remarkable.
Right.
And you would interview Gordie Howe and Ted Lindsay and, the superstars who played for Detroit. But what I really like about this is that I was able to track down and interview the players like Benny White. Bet you never heard of Benny White, right?
No.
Won 4 Stanley Cups with Detroit in 50 and 52 and 54 and 55. He was a role player, right? Mm-hmm. Leo Reese was a key defenseman on those teams. There again, probably never heard of Leo Reese, am I right?
No.
Exactly. See, 50 years from now, everybody's going to remember Steve Yzerman, right?
Oh, of course.
They'll remember Pavel Datsyuk. They will remember the superstars. But you don't win championships without guys like Chris Draper, Kirk Maltby, guys like that. And I was able to go back and get their take on their careers. And it meant a lot to me, and I think it meant a lot to them. Because, again, they, too, are used to Gordie Howe, and rightfully so, but guys like Gordie Howe and Alex Delvecchio, getting the limelight and getting their stories told, but not so much of a chance for these other guys. But they were, I won't say, as important as a Gordie Howe might be, but still key elements in a team. I mean, you win as a team. You've got to have guys like that. You can't have Gordie go out there and play the whole 60 minutes, right?
Exactly. That is so true.
So
yeah.
It was nice to give them a forum, a chance to speak, and I enjoyed talking with them every bit as much. And the nice thing here about Legends of the Detroit Red Wings is that we've been able to include Alex Delvecchio as a chapter. When the original book came out, I just wasn't able to get together with Alex.
Right.
I was able to track him down, but we were never able to get our schedules to sync up. And then this past spring, I sat down with Alex and did the interview with him. And he's a great story in his own right. He'd been a professional hockey player for all of 6 games. When he got the call, he was playing in Indianapolis, and he gets a call one day from Jack Adams saying, "We need you to come play for Detroit, and we're in Toronto, and there'll be a ticket waiting for you at the airport, which in and of itself is kind of a big deal in 1950 because air travel was still relatively new. And so there's this kid, Alex Delvecchio, hopping a flight to Toronto, meets Jack Adams in the lobby of the Royal York Hotel in downtown Toronto, which is where the Red Wings stayed when they played the Maple Leafs there.
Yeah.
There's Adams in the lobby shoving a contract in front of him saying, sign this or you can't play. And Alex says, I didn't even look at it. I just wanted to play. That was my thing. So I signed it. It was like $3,000-$4,000, whatever. I didn't care. And and there he is. He's after six games as a professional hockey player, he's in the National Hockey League, and he stayed there for 22 years. So it was, and the thing is that while I was interviewing Alex, my phone rings. They always go off the most inopportune times, right?
Right.
And I glance over at it, and it's Jerry Green, who, in my view, is the greatest sports columnist in Detroit history. He was a guy that was at the top of his. He's retired now, but he was at the top of his game in the 60s and the 70s. And I always just loved Jerry Green.
Mm-hmm.
And but unfortunately, you know, I'm kind of in the middle of something here, so I couldn't take his call.
Right.
Well, I call him back afterwards. I said, "I'm sorry, Jerry, I couldn't take the call. I was interviewing Alex Delvecchio." And Jerry Green says to me, "What do you mean you were interviewing Alex Delvecchio?" And I'm sort of thinking, how do I answer that? You know, I don't want to sound, you know, flip and say, well, I thought of a series of questions and I was asking them. You know, I said, well,
right.
And I told him,
right.
Well, I'm working on a book and I was interviewing Alex for the book. And Jerry Green says, well, that I don't, he goes, well, that's, I just don't see that as very likely at all. Alex Delvecchio is a recluse. He doesn't talk to people. So I felt like what we have here with Alex Delvecchio being in Legends of the Detroit Red Wings is in itself something pretty special. Because I had noticed there actually, I couldn't find a lot when you do your research. I couldn't find a lot of Alex Delvecchio quotes or a lot of Alex Delvecchio interviews out there. So for him to sit down with me was just one more special thing among all the special things that happened to me in the process of writing these books.
Oh, it's got to be an unbelievable read. I can only imagine, Richard. Now, you know, Richard, I want to shift gears really quick to the Tigers. As they now begin their season, of course, we had Detroit Tigers scout Clyde Weir on the show this week to talk about this year's team and how this season sort of has kind of a definite World Series or bust type of feel to it, Richard. Now, do you echo those feelings? And you also know a little bit about their prospects for 2014 as well.
Well, I'll tell you what, on opening day, which is my chance since I'm not down in Florida.
Right.
Some of the reporters get the chance to be with the team for 6 weeks from when spring training starts in late Florida until the team comes north. They've got a bit of a of the drop on us. But I asked Brad Ausmus, and that may have been the first question I ever asked him. A lot of people say it's World Series or bust for this team. How do you feel about that? And he said, hey, I like the expectation because they wouldn't say that if you didn't have a good team. So it doesn't bother me at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's his mindset. It's been an interesting process this season adjusting as a reporter to Brad Ausmus after years of Jim Leland. Was kind of how can I put this? I think it was caustic. You know, he was he was intimidating.
Yeah,
I think if I had to describe Leland in one word, it would be that intimidating.
Right.
Or at least he would try to intimidate you. And I tried to not let him. I would think to myself again. You know, I've been covering major league managers since Ralph Houk, and I'll tell you a story about Ralph Houk. He was his nickname was the Major. And he was so nicknamed because he was an actual major in the U.S. Army during World War II. He was He was a tough guy. And he chewed tobacco. And if he didn't like your question, I would in the postgame, I noticed on more than one occasion that he would miss the spittoon and hit a shoe, if you know what I'm saying. He literally would keep you on your toes in that fashion.
Oh, man.
So I'm thinking to myself, listen, if I... At you know, in my early 20s, just breaking into the business, if I was able to survive Ralph Houk and not be too intimidated, I should be able to handle Jim Leland. And I tell you something, I had a lot of respect for Jim Leland because you look at the guy's record, 1,600 major league victories, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that to him puts him in the same class of manager as a Tony La Russa or a Sparky Anderson and Earl Weaver. So I felt he deserve to be accorded as much respect as you would if you were talking to those guys. And I always tried to treat him that way. Sometimes it worked. Sometimes he would bark at me just like anybody else, and you never knew with Jim Leland what was going to set him off. You could ask what you thought was an entirely fair, even benign question,
right.
And have him fly off the handle. But I think that was just part of his whole, I'm going to intimidate you guys sort of approach to media relations.
Do you have
and
a?
So it's been an adjustment to deal with Brad Ausmus. And my initial impression of Brad, and granted, I've been down there for what, 6 games, right?
Right.
This most recent homestand, is that it looks to me like he thinks in sound bites. Like it almost doesn't matter what you ask him. The answer is going to be between 18 and 20 seconds in length.
that's good for us.
It is good for us, but I'd like to at some point, and perhaps this will develop over time, I'd like to delve a little deeper.
Right.
Because sometimes Leland, you'd ask him some question, and he'd talk for 10 minutes.
Exactly.
Giving you the answer. And you'd have to edit it, of course, but there's much to be said to said for that. And then another thing Leland used to do, and I always used to like this. He'd remember a couple seasons ago the Tigers had Austin Jackson was hurt, and they brought up Quinton Berry to play center field.
Yes, I remember that. Yep.
Yeah, and the guy's out there. He's making great plays in the field. He's hitting okay. And so I asked Leland something like, "Well, when Jackson gets back, are you going to be able to find a place for Quinton Berry?" And this was one of the questions that kind of set him off. Mm. And again, I'm not sure. I wasn't questioning his judgment. I'm just trying to see what his thought process is.
Yeah.
And he would do this. It was a tactic he would use from time to time. He'd go, "Well, what would you do? Where would you put him? Huh? Where would you put him in the lineup? Who would you sit?" That sort of thing, right?
Right.
And I would always think to myself, "Look it, you've won 1,589 big league games. I haven't won any."
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So why are you asking me? So actually, I was a little upset when the Tigers won on opening day.
Mm-hmm.
Because up until that point, Brad Ausmus and I had won exactly the same number of big league games. Zero. So I was...
He eclipsed your record.
Now I'm four down.
Right.
And he's pulling away from me here.
He is. He definitely is. You got to catch up, Richard.
Exactly, right.
I got to ask you, Richard, do you have a favorite Jim Leland story for us?
No, nothing that immediately jumps up. My memories of him will always be the way he would handle his post-game. I would just call him the gaggle. Reporters come into his office typically 3.5 hours before game time, and we'd sit there and talk baseball with him 30, 45 minutes, something like that. Things have become, over the years, increasingly more formal in baseball. It used to be Sparky Anderson, for example, would just sit in the dugout, and reporters would gather around him, and we'd just talk about the Tigers and talk about baseball in general for half an hour, and then it got moved to the manager's office. And when this season began, Ausmus had moved it to an interview room, which was an excessively sterile environment. You couldn't let your hair down. It just felt like a press conference. He subsequently moved it back to his office, which makes things a little bit more relaxed. But what I will always remember about Jim Leland is that half the time, and maybe more, when he'd go into his office, he'd be stretched out in his couch wearing his baseball underwear. I know, right? Whatever it is they wear under their baseball uniforms,
yeah,
which is sort of like a high-tech long john sort of thing.
Yeah.
And on a few occasions, you'd go in there, and he had this robe, which was it was sort of a mock-up of a Tigers jersey. It had the old English D on it, and it had the same piping you would find on a Tigers jersey. But it was a bathrobe, and it turns out that one of the players, and I can't remember his name now. He plays for Cleveland now. He'd come to Detroit as a free agent, and I'm just drawing a blank on which player it was. But he had gone out. These guys make so much money now. He'd gone out and bought everybody on the team one of these robes with the old English D on the front and with their uniform number on the back.
Wow.
And they looked very nice. But you'd come in there occasionally, more likely for a day game, which had followed a night game the night before.
Yeah.
And there would be Leland lounging on his couch wearing the bathrobe, and I would think to myself, my God, I hope he's got something on under the robe.
Exactly. Oh,
exactly.
That is hilarious. That is hilarious, Richard.
So that's what I will always remember about Jim Leland.
Oh, boy. Well, before I let you go, Richard, you are now collaborating for your third book, of course, due to release this fall, I believe, an update version of the Spartan Sports Encyclopedia. What is that about?
Well, it is a compilation of every MSU sport for every season that MSU has competed in that sport. So you will turn to a specific year, and there will be a summary and stories and photographs about every sport. And what we did when we got this assignment last year was we updated, I'm just working from memory here, I think we had to start at like 90, 91, or maybe it was 91, 92, mm-hmm. starting with that academic year, and update it to the current year. And then they decided that it was originally going to come out last fall. They decided, and I'm glad they did, to push it back here, and it will be released this fall, which gives us the opportunity to write about what turned out to be, I think, a pretty good football season. Oh, by golly, what was, I think a bad personal foul call at the end of the game away from maybe a championship in basketball as well. So we've got some good material in there, but it's not just the baseball and the football and the hockey. We've got all the sports in there, the golf, the tennis, the track and field, gymnastics, all of it is in there. So it's an excellent resource for MSU fans, and it's we'd like to think informative and anecdotal as well. So we try to cover all the bases. It's a very thick book, I can tell you that.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Yeah, the Spartan Sports Encyclopedia will be out this fall. And again, Legends of the Detroit Red Wings. And Al, thanks for having me on to talk about it. It is in stores now.
Hey, there you have that. I'm sure many will be flocking to their laptops to order a few copies right now. Detroit sportscaster Richard Kincaid, and also an acclaimed author as well. Richard, thanks so much. We got to have you on in the future to talk some more Tigers, but
I enjoy that, Al. I had a good time with you today. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me. All right. Again, that's Richard Kincaid. Of course, the Spartan Sports Encyclopedia. That will be out this fall, and he has two other books out right now. He is such a busy, busy man. All right. Well, let's hit the break. When we come back, we're going to, of course, talk about the sad news, the sad passing of 8-year-old Lacey Holdsworth, who meant so much to Spartan Nation, the Michigan State men's basketball team, but more particularly Adrian Payne. We'll talk about that coming right back after the break. You don't want to miss that. Current Sports returns in just a sec. Welcome back to Current Sports. I am your host, Al Martin. Well, I am also joined by Matt Luckey and Alex Sharg right now as we kind of just talk about some very sad news. If you haven't heard, this morning, 8-year-old Lacey Holdsworth, whose battle with cancer, and friendship with Michigan State basketball became national stories. She sadly passed away this morning, losing that fight with cancer. Again, it inspired immediate emotion from MSU men's basketball coach Tom Izzo. He was quoted in a phone interview this morning saying, quote, "I'm supposed to be a guy who leads men, and now an 8-year-old has impacted my life like this. The impact on all of us will be lasting, and that's especially true for Adrian Payne." Of course, Adrian grew a very, very close relationship with Lacey during a visit at Lansing Sparrow Hospital, as the team had a visit there just to meet and greet some patients there, and Adrian Payne got the chance to meet Lacey, who really touched his life immediately from the very first minute that he met her. It also inspired ESPN analyst Dick Vitale to call Lacey's father, Matt, and tell him that he's going to donate $250,000 in her name, with fundraising starting now at dickvitale.com. He fought back tears in a phone interview this morning saying, "I can't believe it. This rips my heart out, man." Guys, this is really sad stuff here. Of course, you know, this story really, really got a lot of national attention, especially during the Spartans' tourney run this season. We saw Lacey down in Indy. We saw her just about at every men's basketball game this season, first off, and then we saw her down in Indy. A really cool moment as Adrian Payne, he took the ladder after MSU had won the Big Ten championship and actually picked Lacey up and let her cut down the nets and hold the nets. A really cool moment, a really cool story. I mean, we always talk about here on Current Sports, going beyond the X's and O's, and this story really epitomizes that. And really, this kind of tugs at your heart a little bit, because you know you talk about a young woman who actually was thought to have beat this disease. They had actually rid her of this this cancer, but then it came right back. And it came back tougher than ever, and really caused it a really, really tough for her to beat it the second time. And, you know, it's really tough because you see the relationship that she had with Adrian Payne, and it was so unique. And you talk about Adrian Payne, and talk about a guy who has dealt with, you know, so much in his life and had to deal with losses time in and time out. I always go back to the story about how he lost his mom sitting there cooking. She starts to have an immediate asthma attack. She runs upstairs. Her face is out the window trying to get air. She tells Adrian to go find her inhaler. Adrian's, you know, yelling at his mom, "I can't find it, mom, I can't find it." She ends up passing out on the bed, dies right in Adrian's arms as a young kid. I mean, that's such a traumatic experience. And then you talk about the passing of his grandmother not too long ago in college. I mean, and his grandmother became that mother, instant mother figure after his mother passed away. And now to develop a relationship with this young lady who really was an inspiration to so many, and to have this happen, it's got to be so tough on him. And I want to just send my condolences to the family of the Holdsworth family, all of our condolences from everyone here at WKAR. This is really a sad news when I read about this morning.
Yeah, what a story. And what really struck me, Al and Matt, was when I see this news and piece of information about Dick Vitale personally calling her family. Basically, he's going to be donating $250,000 in her name. And Jay Billis was tweeting about it. I mean, it's just garnered so much national attention. And it's almost like Lacey was almost waiting for the season to be over. I mean, because this is right after the national championship game. And if Michigan State made it that far, man, how much in full circle would that be if Michigan State really advanced to the next rounds? But yeah, sad day from Spartan Nation. I've never seen so many social media tweets and Facebook messages when it comes to an issue like this ever. I've never seen my social media flood over a personal connection with an athlete. So yeah, just very touched, very touched.
Matt?
It's the most inspirational story of the year. And I think the most important thing is how genuine the friendship was. This wasn't a thing about, you know, promotion. It wasn't anything for the cameras. It didn't start like that. The cameras came. They certainly did, because the story is so great. But it didn't start like that. I mean, this was a genuine friendship that, you know, grew naturally, organically. And it is incredibly sad and heartbreaking that she passed away. But what a fantastic final month of her. I mean, the way that she went out to be a part of the Spartan tournament run, to be a part of the Spartan season, and she was the inspiration for them as far as they went. I mean, she got to cut down the nets, like you mentioned, at the Big Ten tournament, got to go to the tournament games, got to go to the dunk and three-point contest with Adrian. It was like,
right,
you know, it was just, it's a beautiful way to go out. I mean, she was riding high on her way out, and you can't say enough about what she meant to the program. And what the program meant to her. So I think,
right,
more than anything, just how genuine it was. I mean, and Alex, you talk about the social media support, and it's not just Michigan State fans. It's not even fans of sports. I mean, you say it
exactly
goes beyond the X's and O's. It goes beyond sports in general. It
right
was just the relationship between an athlete and a kid. And it's a beautiful thing. And, I mean, it's incredibly sad. But at the same time, it's one of the best things you can get out of sports. It goes
it
beyond
is
winning and losing. It's bigger than that. It
yeah
really is.
It definitely is. And, you know, you talk about the social media support. I mean, I looked on my Instagram today, and so many of my friends, and even a friend of mine, Brittany, she used to work with Athletic Communications, got a chance to really know Lacey. She had pictures posted of her, and it's a really a remarkable story. And, you know, something that really strikes me, guys, is you talk about, you know, her being down there to cut down the nets of the Big Ten tourney, and, you know, her traveling to see MSU play in the in the tournament itself, and at the dunk contest. It looked as though whenever they would show her, she looked like she was doing well. That's what really kind of it comes out of nowhere. And this is really a lesson to everyone out there that, you know, life is precious. Life is too short. You could be here today and gone tomorrow in the blink of an eye. So you got to live each and every day humble and to its fullest, without a doubt. I believe we have a caller right now, Jeremy on line one. How you doing, Jeremy? Welcome to Current Sports.
Hey, how you doing, man? just calling in about Lacey. And, you know, Michigan State's been around for over 159 years, and it's conferred many degrees, and those degrees went on to make profound impacts in this world. But this young lady in 2 years have done what 159 years of those degrees have done, made a profound impact on this world. You know, your heart goes out to Spartan Nation, definitely her family, and definitely AP, as you said earlier. You know, mm-hmm. It seems like significant women in his life he loses. And, you know, you just pray for him. I hope he can recoup, because he's going to have an amazing NBA career. And, you know, yeah. It's just a sad day here in East Lansing. But, you know, you just remember those profound moments that you have with the ones you love. That is what will get you through the heartache, the discomfort of heartache. So,
right, that is so true. Hey, thanks a lot, Jeremy, for the call. We really appreciate it, man. And I'm sure Lacey's family appreciates us too. On behalf of everybody here at WKAR's Current Sports and WKAR in general, we want to send our heartfelt condolences and thoughts and prayers out to the Holesworth family. Again, Dick Vitale, who has really been touched by this story. Again, he's donating $250,000 in her name. Fundraising is starting now at Dick Vitale Online. .com. That's DICKVITALE online.com if you want to contribute to that. Okay, well, ladies and gents, let's kind of transition here to the UConn women. Now, the second time that both the men and the women have swept national basketball championships. Unbelievable. They both did it back in 2004. Now on the 10-year anniversary of that moment, they do it once again. Really a remarkable moment. Gotta give props to Alex, because Matt and I, we chose Notre Dame in that game. I thought Notre Dame was going to come out the gates and play better than they did. They fought hard in the beginning of the game, but it seemed as though UConn was in complete control that entire game.
It's UConn's year. The men clearly inspired them. They were clearly controlled that team, and yeah, Notre Dame was dealing with that injury, like we talked about last week. I think that was the difference for me.
For me, you know, something really stands out to me, Matt, the rebounding. If you look at the rebounding, Notre Dame, they almost, if you look at UConn, looking at UConn and this rebounding battle last night, UConn almost doubled Notre Dame's rebounds yesterday, a 54-31 advantage on the boards. That's the difference of the game to me. They had so many second-chance opportunities. It seems as though all five of UConn's players, they crashed the boards when they could, and Notre Dame just really had no answer. I thought if Notre Dame in that game, if they had any momentum to ride on, I thought that they could have done it in transition more often. They didn't get in transition, and a lot of it has to do with UConn's great defense in transition, but I don't think Notre Dame pushed the ball as much as they could. And UConn, again, I saw no weaknesses in their game throughout that entire game last night, Matt.
Yeah, it was basically a clinic on how to get points in the paint.
Exactly.
I mean, they outscored them, I believe it was 52-22 in the paint, and it was in every conceivable fashion. Like you said, offensive boards, diagonal passes to just absolutely slice and dice the Notre Dame defense.
Yeah.
It was a clinic. I mean, if you want to teach people how to move the ball around the court to get a quality look at the rim, you're going to put on the tape of that game, because it was unlike anything I feel like a lot of people have ever seen. As far as Notre Dame getting out in transition, it's tough to do that when you're constantly taking the ball out of the basket,
mm-hmm.
because
right.
UConn was so efficient on offense. It's tough to get those transition opportunities when they're constantly scoring. So I think Notre Dame, I mean, they kind of kept pace a little bit with the three ball, but when you have a team that is getting layup after layup after layup versus a team that's hitting a few threes, I mean, you tend to err with the layup side, because those are easy looks and they're going to continue to fall, whereas the three-pointer comes and goes.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And if you look at UConn, four or five starters in double figures for UConn. UConn didn't. We talked about that depth. We talked about that a few days ago, you know, previewing this game. And I talked about how deep Notre Dame can go in their bench. They definitely went deep in their bench, and UConn didn't. I kind of expected that. But when you talk about UConn, I mean, they really didn't need to. You know what I mean? When you got four of your five starters in double figures and scoring as efficiently and effectively as they did, I mean, really, I mean, if you like Stephanie Dawson, she had 17 points, 16 rebounds. Yep. I mean, that's unbelievable. And then 7 assists to cap that off. I mean, that's unbelievable. Then you look at Breonna Stewart, who was the player of the year, 21 points for her. It really was a rout and a clinic. And Gino Auriemma, I mean, that program is humming right now. And he's a Hall of Fame guy. It really, they controlled every aspect of the game. And now, you know, you look at this program now for UConn, both the men and women just breeze through the tournament and win national championships. That's unbelievable. I can only imagine what it's like to be a student on that campus. And I was reading a few quotes from different students who were out partying and going crazy. And all of them were saying this is the most unbelievable time they've ever had in their life, a memorable experience. I can only imagine how that campus is right now.
Yeah. Last thing for me to add is two undefeated teams with kind of making a big statement in college and women's college basketball. It was just not even close. It was great for UConn. But it was a disappointing game for me in terms of making a statement for women's basketball.
Really? In what way?
Well, when you're talking about two undefeated gridirons, and we talked about, I mean, it's going to be a really tough game. It was a clinic.
So you wanted a better game.
I wanted a better game because it's the first time women's college basketball was back in a national spotlight since, I'd argue, when Brittany Griner was at Baylor.
You know what? I may have to go the other way on that one, Alex. I think either way, I mean, the attention that this drew with two undefeated programs going at it on the national stage, just the fact that people were able to turn on their television and watch a little bit of that game just for that interest of having two undefeated teams boded well for the game either way, no matter what the outcome. I mean, I thought it's still a staple that you can look at. I'm curious to look at the ratings to see how many people tuned in. I don't know if you guys watched it. I watched about half of it, but then as the blowout started to ensue, I did flip around and change the channel a little bit.
And you wouldn't have had it not
if it had been a close game.
Exactly. I think Alex is right that in terms of looking at just the growth of the women's game, people would have liked to see a tighter game. Mm-hmm. Because now you kind of just look at it and it's, oh, UConn won by 20. Same old, women's basketball is kind of, it's still women's basketball. UConn is still dominating. I think if it was down to the wire, like a buzzer-beating shot, obviously that's the, mm-hmm. you know, the best thing that could have possibly happened.
Right.
I still think that obviously, you know, two undefeated teams meeting in the final is great for the game, mm-hmm. but to have it be a laugher is a bit of a letdown at the end of the mm-hmm. year.
I can see that. I can definitely see that aspect to it, guys. And, yeah, because I think during the end of that game, LeBron and the Nets were playing. And speaking of that game, that was a heck of a game, too. I mean, look, and LeBron cried Plumlee. So much. I tell you, man. LeBron, look, did you see the shot they had of him looking up at the scoreboard at the play? And he thought that he got fouled on the play. I'm like, LeBron, stop crying. Stop whining, man. But that's another subject. Guys, we didn't get to continue our Barbershop Wednesday today. We had, you know, Richard was such a great guest. We had him on for a while. And, of course, we had to talk about the sad passing of Lacey Holdsworth. But we'll get it tomorrow. We'll have a Barbershop Thursday. How's that sound, guys? And our Barbershop
can't wait.
Thursday tomorrow will be was drafting Darko Milicic, Joe Dumars' worst move. I wanted to make some points on that one, but I will reserve those for tomorrow. We'll also talk about the impact of golf. Without Tiger Woods, it's the Masters will take place and start this weekend because, you know, guys, I've been reading around, and the ratings, I think, are definitely going to take a dive. Ticket sales, as soon as Tiger announced that he would not be playing in the Masters, ticket sales immediately declined. I mean, just his overall impact. You can argue that if Tiger's not playing, as far as his impact in just, you know, that sport, that one sport, if Tiger's not playing, you can argue that the impact is so much greater in golf than in any other sport. I mean, because basketball, you have so many multiple superstars. If you know, LeBron happened to get an injury, you still got Kevin Durant and so many others to look at. Football, I mean, there's so many great players in the game of football. I mean, I could go on and on and on. But with golf, it's like if Tiger's not in the running, or if he's not out there playing, it just totally takes a nosedive. So we'll talk about the impact of golf without Tiger. Of course, we'll also have Throwback Thursday for you and so much more. And also want to remind you all that tomorrow, here at the Communication Arts and Sciences Building, the Spartan Sports Journalism Classic will be taking place. And that's when, of course, so many MSU alum who are in the sports broadcasting field will be coming back and talking to students. And there will be a pretty cool panel discussion led by Steve Smith, former MSU great basketball player and who went on to have a pretty good career out in the NBA, who now works for Turner Sports. He'll be leading that panel discussion and talking about the Olympics and how it's covered and how it was covered during the past Winter Olympic Games this year. You don't want to miss that. You can sign up for free and be a part of that live
live audience tomorrow night by signing up on WKAR.org. All right, well, thanks so much to all of you who tuned into today's Current Sports. I want to give a special thanks to Richard Kincaid, author and broadcaster, who joined me today. You've been listening to Current Sports with me, Al Martin, on WKAR East Lansing. And as always, take care, have one fantastic hump day, and be easy, people.